Digital Media Insider, Episode 22, February 15, 2008. Welcome to Digital Media Insider from O'Reilly.com. On our website, we explore the future of audio, video, and photography to help you get more creative with technology. I'm David Bettino, and I edit the audio section of the site. In the last episode, we spoke with Francis Prev, who produced six top 10 remixes in 2007. One of the secrets of his success is that he really knows how to coax the sounds he wants out of today's hardware and software. But Francis doesn't just keep those sounds for himself. He's also the principal sound designer for Ableton, which makes the program I use to produce this podcast, Ableton Live. Francis also designed sounds for the Korg Oasis, perhaps the most expensive commercial synthesizer in the world. So, what does a sound designer do?
A sound designer, whenever when you buy a synth from Guitar Center, wherever you buy your synths from, software synth, and it comes with a bunch of presets. And those presets are made by somebody. And in the case of a lot of the Ableton stuff, that somebody's me. Mm-hmm. So I also do the same thing for, I've done a bunch of stuff for the effects that are shipping with Live. When Live 5, I guess it was, came out, and they added beat repeat and a few other things. I also did a bunch of work on the effects for that.
So making the effects presets are actually...
Making the presets. They throw me alphas and betas of the... for instance, my first gig for Ableton was in 2004. I had written a lot of tutorials for keyboard and for my Power Tools for Looping software book, basically covering in-depth tutorials on Ableton Live. And at AES, Dave Hill from Ableton approached me and said, hey, you clearly are pretty deep into our product. We have a soft synth coming out. At the time, it was Operator, which was their first a la carte device. Mm-hmm. And he asked me if I'd be interested in, he asked me if I knew FM. And I was like, yeah, I know FM. I like FM a lot. Actually. At the time, there were like 8 or 9 programmers working on it, and they needed 100 presets. And all of the programmers were submitting 30 to 100 presets of their own, and the best ones would be selected. And of the presets I submitted, a very sizable portion of them were selected for inclusion in an Operator. And from there, you know, we just had a great relationship going forward from that.
I asked Francis how much creative direction he got from Ableton. Did they request specific sounds or types of sounds?
They say that they want a balanced, you know, variety. You know, most synthesizer manufacturers, when they give you an assignment like that, they're like, you know, go easy on the sound effects. You know, we don't need a lot of those. Uh-huh. You know, and make sure that everything's, you know, melodic and playable and covers a wide variety of styles and applications. Mm-hmm. Use case scenarios, as they say.
What are some of those scenarios?
You know, like bass sounds. You have to have a sort of familiarity with the current landscape of electronica. I'd say it has to be a 30-70 balance between cutting edge and modern and, you know, timeless. You don't want the stuff to be expired by the time it ships.
Right.
70% timeless and 30% modern.
Yeah, I remember Jack Hotop, the Korg sound designer for many years, was telling me he would often go into music stores and just play around in all the different keyboards from different manufacturers and get a sense of what was current. But I imagine you're also listening in a variety of other places.
Yeah, I'm relating it to what's happening on Beatport and in the worldwide dance scene. It's interesting you should bring up Jack, because Jack and I have worked together a bunch on some Korg projects. Mm. And he's just an amazing guy. He's been a bit of a mentor for me in the sound development area, especially working on, you know, those high visibility projects that I've been doing for Korg.
Here's Jack Hotop playing one of Francis Prev's Oasis sounds, Solar Wind. Notice how he shapes it in real time with the keyboard's ribbon, joystick, and knob controllers. Jack Hotop on the Korg Oasis Mod 7 FM synthesizer. For a link to a high-res video of Jack playing the Oasis, see the show notes at digitalmedia.com www.oreilly.com. Here's another prev patch for the Oasis, Electro. Play it, Jack. Francis Prev uses Ableton Live in his own music, so I wondered if he'd use the same factory presets as everyone else, or some private stash.
There are two sides to that. I mean, I think if anybody's allowed to use my presets, it's me. So I'm not really averse to that. There are certain things that I really, really like to do, sonically, sound design-wise, that are part of my own bag of tricks. There's a sort of tuned noise sound that you'll find in pretty much every bank I do. I always try to do a variation on that sound because I like it so much. You know, I like bell sounds every once in a while. I don't get a chance to use them so much in my music, but I really like making them, and I like, you know, using them in the privacy of my own home. Yeah, so those types of things will creep in there. But I also do, for my own use, whenever I'm designing a bank, I will try to throw in a bunch of really good starting points. I'll call them either inits or defaults. Simpler has a bunch of inits, each with a different waveform. Because when we were working on Simpler, I said to the Ableton guys, you know, we really should have just a plain vanilla square wave, a plain vanilla sawtooth, sine wave, so on and so forth, so people can just use them as starting points. And they liked the idea, so we went ahead with it, and I came up with a bunch of defaults that are just really good places to, you know, begin whatever type of work you're trying to do. Same with like bass sounds. You know, I'll try to come up with like vanilla bass, vanilla pad, and so on and so forth. Mm. So, you know, those are the two kinds of approaches there in terms of presets that I start from.
So you've whipped up a bunch of presets that you think you'll like and you turn them in. What happens next? Is there some kind of voting?
One of the reasons Ableton and I get along so well is because there tends to be very little, you know, back and forth in the revision process. That's not to say that they, you know, they accept everything sight unseen. I mean, they'll kick back stuff every once in a while, and they'll go, you know, this, there'll be technicalities. In one case, there were some of the macros that I was working on in the most recent revision where they wanted me to take a slightly different approach with them, but they were really minor revisions overall. Mm. So generally, in the initial meetings, they give me a very, very clear idea of what they want in terms of, you know, variety and types of sounds and so on and so forth, and then they just sort of turn me loose on it. And a lot of times, I'll do a little bit more than I actually need. So rather than going back and having to revise stuff, you know, if they need 100 patches, I'll give them 120, and they can just pick the best 100 out of that.
Mm-hmm. I keep thinking about how this relates to hardware synthesizers. I think a lot of people, keyboardists certainly, have had the experience where you go into a music store and you turn on the keyboard and it comes up to preset 00, and then that is the definitive sound of the instrument. It's, you know, like the universe sound. And the M1 or something like that.
It's funny, we both said universe.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was Universe, the first sound in the Korg M1. I grabbed it from episode 11 of Digital Media Insider, Synthmania. You can hear all episodes for free at digitalmedia.oreilly.com or at the iTunes store. Speaking of the M1, I asked Francis about designing sounds for Korg's hardware synthesizers.
I've really only done one hardware project for Korg, and that was the new Mod 7. Module that shipped with the Oasis, I guess it was released a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. And that was an FM synth, and there was a huge team working on it, and my presets are a fraction of what's actually in there. I mean, Jack's got a ton of stuff in there. Peter Schwartz has a ton of stuff in there. Mm. I mean, these guys are, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, as I'm wandering around my life, I'll think to myself, wow, yeah, I'm doing this really great work for Korg and Ableton. And then, you know, I hear Jack and Peter's presets, and I go, wow, I still have so far to go. So when you're doing the hardware stuff, especially for a flagship like the Oasis, it's like that, you know, it's a $10,000 synth. The stakes are a lot higher. So you really have to, every sound has to be, you know, a universe unto itself.
Mm. I actually remember one of the other Korg guys, he was describing some of their sound design meetings to me where they'll all gather around and then someone will play a preset and then Jerry Kowarski would say, hey, wait, how'd you do that? And then they'd kind of have this little mini class inside the Korg offices and they would say, okay, well, I used this filter on that and I set this envelope upside down and applied it to pitch or something like that. So he said sometimes it was kind of distracting because they would get into the how you did it effect.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. Yeah, that's happened with Korg. One of the discussions that I'd had with Jack when we were first kicking off the Mod 7 project is I figured out how to get hard sync out of FM. Like a very, very accurate simulation of Classic 2 oscillator hard sync sounds. And the first time I did that was actually in a preset for Ableton's FM synth called Operator.
Mm.
In the Operator presets, it's synth, and then inside that there's a folder called lead, and then in the lead folder there's something called hard synchronicity. And that particular patch is me managing to coax hard sync out of FM. So when I first jumped on the project for the Oasis for the Mod 7, I was like, I wonder if Mod 7 can do this little hard sync trick just like Operator. And sure enough, it could. So that was one of the first 10 or 15 patches that I submitted because I really wanted to make a good first impression. So
right.
I looked back on some of the highlights of my FM programming tricks, and that was one of them. And I did a few others that made use of a certain stylistic idioms in my own sound design. And I sent them in, and that's when exactly that kind of conversation came up. I mean, I had Jack and Peter and Jerry going, how'd you do that? I was like, oh, well, you make sure that the first, the first operator is the carrier is set to a square wave, and then the modulator is set to a triangle, and the ratios are the carrier is fixed, and so on and so forth. So if you look at the Mod 7 or the operator patch, you can kind of reverse engineer it from that. So.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the neat things about synthesizer patches. I want to talk about that for a second.
Sure.
Is that synth patches, thank God, are all open source. You know, people don't think about that, but when you get a synth patch, it's like no one's hiding. It doesn't have to be assembled in any way. No one's hiding what's going on under the hood, and it's the best way to learn how to make these patches. If you hear a sound that rocks your world, you go fire up the synth and look at what the settings are and figure out what's going on. And I think that open source component of sound design and synth patches is what helps keeping the ecosystem moving along.
That's a really interesting insight. That's probably a big reason that the web took off, is that everything is right there. One little click away.
Right. And HTML is pretty darn open source as well.
Yeah. So. Okay, so the $10,000 Oasis shows up at your door. When a new instrument like that comes into your studio, how much training do you get on it, or do they just...
You have really good telephone support is what you've got. But other than that, it's you're definitely kind of kicked out of the nest and told to fly, so... And the interesting thing about the Oasis that showed up at my door, there's an interesting story about it, is that I have a prototype. Because the production models, obviously they want to sell those. So I have one of the early prototypes of the Oasis, which really looks like MacGyver built it. I mean, it's got this sort of Mad Max aesthetic where there's like certain, the labels are written in Sharpie. And everything is exposed. There's absolutely no cosmetics to it whatsoever. It's a really, really cool looking synth. When people come over and see my studio, they go, what the hell is that? And I'm like, oh, that's the Oasis. But when it showed up, I was like, we had built into the project a month and a half for me to familiarize myself with it. And it took that time. It's deep. It's a deep synth. The Oasis has this... incredible cinematic quality to it. It's just massive.
Maybe you could talk a moment about the raw sound sources that you use as you're building up your sounds. You've said you had a few square wave templates you started with, but
oh, okay. It It depends on what I'm doing. I mean, I've done two FM projects, and FM is, if you're using a 4-op synth like the operator, I'll use the algorithm that has two carrier modulator pairs, and I'll treat them as two layers in the sound. That's one of my favorite starting points, and it's a real obvious one, but it's very easy to control.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll have two carrier modulator pairs. If I'm using a 6-op synth like Mod 7, one of the things that I did for quite a few of my patches is that I have the two carrier modulator pairs, and then I had two more operators left over, which I would use as strictly carriers, and I'd give them more complex waveforms than sine waves. So I basically ultimately had a four oscillator or a four layer synth where, you know, I've got two carrier modulator pairs and then two more carriers. And I'd have the two additional carriers handle the sort of bread and butter patty stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then the two carrier modulator pairs handle the, you know, the more percussive or rhythmic components to the sound. That's, you know, when I'm working in FM. When I'm working in a classic subtractive environment, I find I like, as I said earlier, using effects as part of the synth chain. So what I'll do is I'll come up with a really, you know, vanilla, straightforward kind of patch, sometimes even with just a gated envelope, and then use the effects to really, really take it up to the next level. On the other hand, sometimes I'll just be going through the library, the encyclopedia, if you will, of classic synth sounds. When I was working on Live 5, there's a simpler patch that I did. Yeah, I believe you have to have the simpler power, which is an additional library. It's on the Ableton website, and it's got my name on it. It's Simpler Power by Francis Prev. And in there's a patch called TEEBEE. And I was bound and determined to coax a classic 303 sound, a Roland TB-303. Bass line sound out of Live, and I started with a square wave that I sampled from another soft synth that shall remain nameless. Then I put a little bit of EQ in it. But the secret to the TB-303 sound, if anybody's trying to make it with, you know, any other type of environment, you start with either a square or a saw. Often the square sounds a little bit better, and you give it a very, very, very highly resonant low pass filter.
Mm-hmm.
With a pretty radical filter envelope, so it's got that quacking duck-like pew pew kind of funky sound.
Is that a two-pole or a four-pole?
The 303 was actually a three-pole, as I understand it. The circuitry in the 303 was two-pole resonant followed by a one-pole non-resonant. Don't hold me to that. That's an urban myth. But a fairly well-vetted one. That's what I was told that the 303 has. So a lot of people refer to it as an 18 dB filter per octave. Uh-huh. But so what I'm doing in simpler is I'm actually, a lot of times you can coax that sound out of a bandpass, a resonant bandpass filter. So you ratchet up the resonant sound that to narrow the peak of the band, and then you sweep the filter with that. Or if I were just using a low pass, I'd probably use a two-pole. Depends on how squelchy I wanted it. If I wanted it really squelchy, I'd use a four-pole because the resonance just sounds better on a four-pole.
Uh-huh.
But the secret there is burning it into a distortion. The distortion is what gives you that really, really crunchy, in-your-face, acid house sound from, you know, 1987, 88. Check this out. So the secret there is to run it through a really, really nice distortion, and the Ableton saturator is amazing for that. And then after that, I ran it through a little ping pong delay just to, you know, make it bounce around the stereo field a little bit.
Uh-huh. Wait, speaking of the recipes for sound design, you've been doing a series of articles at Beatport about that?
Yes.
What are some of the questions you're getting from readers, or what are the things that they really want to know that you're looking to address?
Well, Beatport is the new community site. Beatportal, BEATPORTAL.com, is really focused on the DJ community. I mean, Beatport's users are, you know, DJs and club music aficionados around the world. So a lot of these people are not coming at it from, you know, with the depth of knowledge that, you know, the producers and synthesists have. So as technology editor, my goal is to really, really get these people up to speed, because DJs approach music differently than musicians. It's a phenomena that couldn't have happened until the end of the 20th century, when you have beat matching and, you know, the idea of an aggregator or a tastemaker or a filter, which is what a DJ is. A good DJ there are two kinds of DJs. There are jukeboxes and there are storytellers, and both have their purposes. I know wedding DJs who make way more than club DJs. So, you know, there are no value judgments here. But if you're going to be a storyteller, you have to have a sound. Mm-hmm. And that sound is ultimately your taste in music. If you want to be able to sleep at night and live with yourself when you're spinning, you definitely want to have, you know, your sound be reflective of your, you know, your own likes and dislikes in terms of music.
I was really fascinated by the idea of DJ as filter, especially following on our talk about resonant filters. I wonder if adding some resonance to your DJ filtering helps bring out the personality.
Yeah, well, yeah, you sort of, as a musician, whether you're a DJ, whether you're, you know, a musician, whether you're a filmmaker, the secret to defining your own sound is really to exaggerate the things you like and downplay the things you don't, until it almost, I don't want to say caricature because that word is really loaded, but you really do have to get a laser focus. There's a Dr. Seuss quote, be who you are and say what you feel, because the people who matter don't mind and the people who mind don't matter. Uh-huh. And that quote is, if you lead your life as an artist through that, or just as a person through that quote, you'll find that you tend to attract, you know, the people who are you know, sympathetic or simpatico to your ideals, and you tend to repel people who you don't get along with, and that makes life a little bit easier than faking it.
For links to the people and software discussed in this episode, see the show notes at digitalmedia.oreilly.com. My thanks to Francis Prev for sharing his insights and Seussisms over two episodes. To hear his music, visit FAP7.com. That's FAP plus the numeral 7. Thanks also to Jack Hotop for contributing the Korg Oasis examples. You've been listening to Digital Media Insider, the official podcast of the O'Reilly Digital Media site. Visit us at digitalmedia.oreilly.com. That's O-R-E-I-L-L-Y. And let us know what creative technologies you'd like to explore. As always, I wrote this music using software that I learned about while editing articles for the site. See the show notes for links. For O'Reilly Digital Media, I'm David Pitino.